100% born in the Appalachian Mountains and made in the USA, Timber Ninja Outdoors provides a range of mobile hunting options to accommodate diverse hunting preferences. Whether you prioritize comfort, lightweight design, or versatility, their two-panel and single-panel saddles collection has something for everyone. The Black Belt Nano is the lightest single-panel saddle available on the market, weighing in under a pound. The saddle is designed with the minimalist hunter in mind, focusing on lightweight functionality and breathability. One notable feature is the patent-pending magnetic stick clip system on the side, which allows for convenient transportation of sticks up the tree, as well as a built-in platform holder. The Nano saddle can be folded up to the size of a Nalgene bottle, enabling easy portability. With a four-way stretch material on the back for a comfortable fit, as well as strategically placed padding for hip pinch relief, you can use code EASTMEETSWEST to get free shipping on any Timber Ninja order. If you try it out and don't like it, send it back within 30 days for a full refund. Learn more at TimberNinjaOutdoors.com and sign up for their email newsletter for exclusive discounts and product drops. When it comes to optics, I get the same question over and over again. What are the best all-around binoculars? Well, it's tough to find something that works in every condition great, but after using a pair of Maven B1.2 10x42s, I think I found them. They feature an 8x or a 10x option, superior low light performance, tack sharp edge-to-edge clarity, a generous depth of field, and a silky focus mechanism. All of Maven Optics have a lifetime no-fault warranty and hail from the great state of Wyoming. I've been using Maven Optics since I bought my first pair in 2017, and I think you should test them out for yourself. Head over to mavenbelt.com and use the code EASTMEETSWEST-GIFT for a free gift with any full-price optics order. For all of those that want a truck bed cover for work or play, Diamondback makes the top-of-the-line, heavy-duty covers that help you do more with your truck. They're perfect for the truck-owning, avid sportsmen, outdoor enthusiasts, and weekend project warriors. I'm currently using the HD cover that is capable of holding up to 1,600 pounds on the top. And then I have the Yakima Overhaul HD bars on top so I can put my rooftop tent on it. When I'm not using my rooftop tent and able to use the trifold design of the Diamondback, I have the Crossbin 8 in there to organize all of my stuff in the back of my truck bed. Diamondback is made right here in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. If you want to check them out, head over to diamondbackcovers.com. If you've wanted that hunting camp tradition that we talk about, that experience, but you don't have a hunting camp of your own, you're welcome to come stay at my hunting camp up here in the Pennsylvania Wilds called the Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds. So if you go over to Airbnb, you can check out our three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath house that's right in the heart of Pennsylvania elk country. It's only minutes away from a bunch of public land to be able to hunt, hiking trails, outdoor recreation, fishing, all of those things there. The house is completely fully stocked with everything that you need to be able to spend a week hunting deer, taking your family up to see the elk, anything like that. So if you head over to Airbnb and search Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds, you'll find my listing there and you can rent out my house. Send us a message, an inquiry that you're interested in it and mention that you heard it on the podcast here, then we'll get you 10% off of your first stay.
Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt podcast presented by Spartan Forge. On today's episode, I am joined by my buddies Ethan Demai and Justin Mueller at the end of our DIY Alaska moose hunt. We discussed the dream of hunting Alaskan moose, troubles on the way, getting dropped off at the wrong lake, judging a bull moose, lessons learned, the best and worst gear, and all of the good stories from the trip, and some of the bad ones. But on this week's Mountain Buck Monday Story of the Week, we have a really good one coming in from Oklahoma and Bradley Hunt. So Bradley wrote in, this is a story about a buck I've had on camera for 3 years now in a proper in a row that was on a property I wasn't very familiar with, and I had been trying to learn. The property had lots of pines and some very steep, rugged terrain. and I'm used to hunting in more flat country, so this has all been a new experience for me and a challenge to figure out, especially the wind. We honed in on a fire road that was made years ago for controlled burns that was about two-thirds of the way up the mountain and made a great bedding slash travel route for the deer. We put a stand on that fire road that went over a saddle that also had a little finger ridge and a small drainage. I hunted my first sit in that spot on November 11, 2022, and it was raining all morning hard, and it started to let up around 7 o'clock, so I made my way to the stand in the light rain. I spooked a big buck getting settled into the stand. So I pulled my grunt tube out and made a few grunts. I heard something coming from the opposite direction that the big buck I spooked ran. And I saw another buck was coming and that he was big. I ended up putting an arrow in him at 30 yards. I then texted my brother and my brother-in-law that I shot a big one. And 5 minutes later, my brother-in-law, who was sitting on the same fire road in a stand about 400 yards away, shot a big eight. So we got to retrieve our bucks together. It was a super awesome day and so cool to double on two big bucks within 5 minutes. On top of that, neither of us killed the big buck that I spooked. Mine was 156 inch 10 point and his was 130 inch 8 point. Man, these bucks are some absolute bruisers. I recommend anybody go check them out. I have them posted over East Meets West Hunt on Instagram and East Meets West Outdoors on Facebook. Just some beautiful deer and from some of the mountain country in an unlikely place of Oklahoma. You think of Oklahoma as being mostly flat, but there's some definitely really good hill country and mountains and big woods stuff that's there too. So that's pretty awesome. Bradley, thanks for sharing that story. If you have a mountain buck story that you would like to submit, please send that in to my email, bodiesmeetswesthunt.com. I would love to be able to share it with everybody. And yeah, just send a paragraph or two with some photos and all those details and love to be able to share it. This week, I am in South Dakota hunting mule deer slash whitetail, but mostly mule deer, with my family. So I'm going with my dad, my cousin Mason, cousin Tyler, and a couple of my uncles. So it's just a family trip. It should be pretty fun. I'm looking forward to it. I don't plan on doing any filming or anything. It's just a hunt that we want to do as a family and get together and have some fun with it. So going to be gone this whole week and into the beginning of next week. So try to reach me. That's where I'll be at. And really this whole fall, there'll be some delayed responses, but I'm really looking forward to this trip. And at the time this releases, I'll be on it. In other news, we have the weekly Q&A podcast will start to release this Friday. So it'll be a quick 10 to 20 minute episode that comes out answering your questions. So if you have any questions for the Q&A podcast, please submit that to my email, bodiesmeetswesthunt.com, and make sure you put in the subject line that it is for the Mountain Buck Q&A podcast. And I'd love to be able to go through and put and answer those questions there. I did say in an earlier episode that I would not be doing a video version, but that has now changed and I am doing a video version. So I have that on YouTube. You can also submit questions by leaving comments on those YouTube videos there and would love to be able to answer them. And lastly, as always, if you find value in this podcast, please share it with your friends, give a rating and review. Those things help out so much. And thanks everyone for listening and good luck this October. All right. We're live up in Alaska, interior Alaska, just getting back from a moose hunt and excited to be here with my buddies. So you guys you definitely would recognize old Justin Mueller here, who's been along on a lot of my hunts since 2019. Filming any of the stuff that looks pretty that shows out in some of the content I do that comes from old Justin.
Yeah, it's good to be here. We finally got back to town, got some good food, took showers.
Yeah.
Everyone's feeling pretty good.
Nice. Yeah. Long showers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm also joined here by a new guest, but it's been a friend of mine for the last probably 4 years or so, Ethan Demai, which I was pronouncing your last name wrong for the whole time I was knowing you and until this trip.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Bo. It's good to be here. And yeah, it's good to be, it was a great trip. It's definitely good to be out of the bush and sleeping in a bed and hot showers and
yeah,
not freeze dried food.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely needed some showers. My, this long, long hair, I thought I could get past, you know, the greasiness of it, and it didn't, wasn't necessarily the case for 2 weeks. So
yeah, we never saw the other side of it.
No, I thought, I feel like I heard Donnie Vincent say somewhere that like it gets greasy after a few days and then it goes and just gets back to normal after a while. I never got there.
No, you just needed a few more days at least.
Yeah.
Still pretty greasy.
A few more months or something to see what happens, but it was pretty disgusting. I'll tell you that. I couldn't stand it. The rest of my body I could clean, but couldn't, I had no way of drying my hair if I washed it.
Yeah.
I sound like a chick saying that, but it's the nature of the beast, I guess. But before we get rolling here, Ethan, do you want to give a little background on yourself, kind of what you do for a living and just kind of how you got to this point?
Sure. So I'm also from Pennsylvania. I live in the northeast corner. And so for the last 5 years or so, I've guided full time. And that being full time, it's kind of like a collective thing. You got to travel with the seasons, you know. So like whitetail and turkey out in the Midwest, and then waterfowl in Montana, and then do some upland stuff back home at a pheasant preserve when I'm around, and then through the summer months, guide bow fishing in upstate New York, and then the last couple of years, I have gotten to do some rep work for Sitka. And then I guess in addition to that, I'm kind of a wild game nerd too, and do a lot of cooking and butchering stuff and some recipes. And for the last couple of years, I've done some field to table events for new hunters, walking them through, you know, just basics of hunting to shooting a whitetail doe and putting it on their plate and everything in between and what that looks like.
Yeah. You got a lot of things rolling on your plate. Yeah. And it seems like every time I talk to you, I learn something new. If somewhere you're guiding or doing different things. And I think it's pretty cool. You know, I went bow fishing with you twice now in New York, yeah. Refraction Guide Service. So anybody is looking to do that. And New York, it's a freaking blast to be able to go shoot carp all night. And just, man, it's fun to get to be able to do that. And just getting to know you through that and through shows and everything. But what's really cool too about your story is kind of the same as, you know, Justin and myself, where it's just like you wanted something different. You owned a construction company for 10 years and then decided one day that, you know, I'll let you tell a story there.
Yeah. I mean, so I was, I had a residential construction company for 10 years. It was going well. Had all the work I could ask for and I don't know. I mean, trying to think, it was 2019. At that point, I've been guiding on the side for several years, collectively a few things. And I just kind of had enough of the construction and all the stress. And I just woke up one day and decided, I was like, you know what? I'm going to try to make a living in the outdoors and pack up the whole construction thing. And didn't really know what that looked like. I knew it was a lot of guiding and a lot of travel. But I knew that I'd kind of need something else to supplement that, and just kind of toughed it out and took a leap of faith, and everything's worked out and you know, a lot better than what I could have hoped for, you know. So
yeah, no, that's awesome to hear. I mean, it's not easy to be able to do that and take that jump, and you know, especially, I mean, you've been self-employed since you were 18 years old. You know, you mm-hmm. never, you know, you didn't follow the traditional route of going somewhat, you know, going to work for a company and then deciding you're done with it. You went, did your own company and decided you were done with it and wanted to do something a little bit different. And that's what's cool, is really anybody can have the ability to shift paths in life. And it's not really ever too late, to not sound cliche, but it's true.
Sure.
To be able to do that. And guiding, it's, you know, I think guiding is one of those things to me that a lot of people that look at, you know, want to get in and hunt and stuff all the time, like, oh man, it'd be cool to be a guide. But like seeing what the amount of work you have to do, because, you know, say if you want to be a whitetail guide, that's only a couple months out of the year. You got to find work throughout it. You know, you're guiding waterfowl and you're shooting stingrays in Florida in March and April with, you know, guiding bow fishing and then, you know, in New York. And it's just like, there's a lot of things that piece that together. And it's not easy to be able to do that and make a living, but it sounds like it's pretty fulfilling.
Yeah. It's, I had a had a good friend of mine that has been in outfitting for 20 some years. In 2019, when I was getting ready to kind of take that leap, he was like, man, he's like, you're not going to make a ton of money being a full-time guide, but it's just a lifestyle thing. And, you know, he's like, not everybody's cut out for it. He's like, but he's like, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And too, like it, I remember when we met and we went back and forth, and I can't remember if it was at a trade show or ATA or Great American Outdoor Show, whatever it was. But I remember specifically you coming up to me and being like, man, like your story of going out west reminds me of the first time I went to Alaska. And you started telling the story about, you know, caribou hunting in Alaska in 2018 for your first time. And we really kind of bonded on that side of things.
Yeah, you know, I think we chatted a little bit on Instagram, and like I was traveling so much at the time, you didn't know whether I was from Missouri or Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we chatted a little bit on Instagram, and we had never actually met, but just following your stuff, you know, you just do a good job of being relatable and just, you know, as another guy that grew up in Pennsylvania, just hunting whitetail and turkey that like to try to roam around out west once in a while, I definitely, you know, connected, you know, related to your stuff, and was just like, you know, felt like you would be somebody that would be fun to run around with and hunt with and just, you know, whatever, you know, and sometimes you meet people through the industry too, and you're disappointed when you meet them, you know, and you know, that obviously wasn't the case since we're sitting here, you know, but we finally met at Harrisburg. I think you were working the Maven booth.
Yeah.
And we just started chatting a little bit. And then, so I was on the heels of that caribou hunt that you were talking about in 2018. You were getting ready to go that upcoming year.
Yes.
So we kind of, you know, we talked about the caribou and, you know, the little knowledge I had about it, I tried to convey, and then we just kept in touch and we went bow fishing and been friends ever since.
Yeah. No, that all makes sense. And it's funny that we ended up, you know, moose hunting together, you know, a few years later. And that's not like, And I've told you this, and Justin knows it too. Like, I keep my circle of people that I hunt with, especially on hunts like this, very small, because you just don't know what you're going to get into. And so it's like, I was like, man, you know, going. But after getting to know you and going bow fishing and seeing some of your past, you know, past experience and like just the level of training and the other stuff you do with discipline and everything, it was like, I was like, I think we can make this work out.
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate that more than, you know, it's definitely not lost on me, because I, you know, I often talk about how I don't do Western trips or backcountry trips with just anybody. It's obviously like a very small group of people that you want to sign up to do that with, you know, people that are going to put the work in, pull their weight and, you know, not make excuses and obviously capable people. But then when you're, you know, you're talking about like a fly-in trip in Alaska with, you know, and you're obviously in grizzly country and stuff too, that circle gets a lot smaller. And, yeah. You know, the fact that we hadn't hunted together prior to this, you know, aside from bow fishing, obviously, which is totally different.
Yeah.
Like, it's not lost on me, the leap of faith and trust that you took, like signing on to come do this hunt with me. And I really appreciate you having that and coming along on this trip.
No, man, I mean, I appreciate the opportunity that, cause so just to give everyone a background, kind of what I want to do with this podcast is kind of start at the beginning a little bit, not dives too much in logistics and everything, but just kind of start to build that framework of December of last year. You called me and was like, hey, I have an opportunity to go on a moose hunt in Alaska, DIY, unguided, fly in. Do you want to go? I'm like, holy cow. He's like, and you have like 3 days to make a decision. Cause just the way that it works as far as with these transport, I mean, if anyone listened to the podcast I did with Kyle Hansen back in January of 2023, he talked about unguided moose hunting usually takes 4 or 5 years of trying to get in, just to get in with somebody to be able to do it. And honestly, I was like, I don't know if I can swing it financially, from a time standpoint. I just got an Idaho elk tag, which I was fired up about because I hadn't been there since I killed a bull and like all these things. And I was like, what do I do? And I remember I was talking to my girlfriend about it, and she was like, this is your dream, just do it. Like, and at first she was like, if you're worried about, like, you know, being able to pay for the filming and all that stuff, don't film it, just go do it and make it a vacation for you, you know. And obviously I wanted to have it filmed, and I want to have my buddy Justin along, so I figured out, you know, the process of getting that done. But it was I was like, it took a while to settle in that it was real and it was happening. And then, yeah, we kind of just had to make it happen in that time period. And I truly believe, like, with some of these things, even though I feel like you're never in a situation where you feel perfect about being able to do any big thing. You know what I mean? Like, you're not always like in the perfect financial situation or this, but it's like, I have a date, now it's time to work towards it and get ready at that point.
Yeah, there's something about that mindset that's kind of like, I don't know how I'm going to pull this off, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a little bit more backstory on how this hunt came about. So this particular air taxi service, I hunted with them in 2018. They're pretty tough to get in with, even, you know, as a return customer. They don't necessarily have enough spots for all their return customers. In the last 2 years, I had been trying to come back up here and do another caribou trip with my now fiance, Courtney, and then a couple of buddies that wanted to come do this trip. And what Courtney's wanted ever since she was a little kid more than anything in the world is to go hunt Alaskan caribou. Like, that's just been her dream. So I've been trying to get a spot for caribou. And I've been there, done it, but I was happy to go and do it again. But I was simultaneously trying to get a spot for moose because that's my dream hunt. I don't have a lot of bucket list hunts per se, like, you know, like in my head of like, oh, I want to do this, this, and that. But I know that like moose is at the top of it. Like, ever since I was a kid, like, I've just wanted to come to Alaska and hunt a moose. So for the last couple of years, I've been trying to get a spot for either or, hoping to get one or the other, and been unsuccessful. And then this year I learned that I got a spot for both. Right. So I'm like, well, I can't tell them we're not going on a caribou hunt because I'm going to go on this moose hunt. It just seemed a little too selfish, and I was going to nix the moose hunt. And, you know, given the logistics and whatnot, you know, too, I knew that obviously I wasn't going to go on this trip alone. And excuse me, I called you, see if you want to go on this trip. And in my back of my head, I'm like kicking around. I'm like, gosh, I'm going to have to cancel. I'm going to have to give up this moose spot because you were in the same boat. Like, you were already going to Alaska. I was going to Alaska in August for caribou. You had an Alaskan trip planned, and we're just like, man, we don't ball on that kind of budget. We can't just swing two Alaska trips in 1 year. But we both arrived at the same conclusion, this moose hunt thing. It's just not getting cheaper or easier to get these spots. And you don't know what tomorrow brings, if there is a tomorrow. And we're just like, man, we gotta figure it out. And we gotta make this thing happen. And also, too, I didn't tell you at the time, I was guiding waterfowl in Montana on the Missouri River. And me and the dog almost went down the river guiding and didn't come out that couple day window where we're trying to decide whether we're going or not. And I'm like, got home, I was like, I'm going on that moose hunt. So I took it on the chin, and I was like, I'm going to make both these things happen, and here we are.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. What about for you, Justin? Have you never filmed a moose hunt before or anything?
No, I've been trying to find a moose hunt for the last 5 years. You know, it's always been something I've wanted to do, and you called me, and you know, you were kind of like, we're still working details, just wanted to know if you're interested. I was like, I'm interested, you know. And I don't know, it was probably a couple weeks later you called and said we're doing it. And
yeah.
No, I mean, it's been great. It's been a hunt where, you know, I've done a lot of deer and elk and stuff like that. And it's all a lot of fun, but moose has always kind of been that dream hunt. And I think for a lot of people, including myself, where it's just something you just want to do.
Yeah, no, that's true. And it's actually funny. So Justin is two to three days after we get back, you turn around and going on another moose hunt. Just so happened you got two of them this year.
Yeah, I got this hunt and then a moose hunt in British Columbia, and I'll be home for 4 days. So never had a moose hunt before. Now we have back-to-back ones. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Learning a lot, right?
That's right.
But yeah, no, so that was cool. That was kind of the planning process there, is doing that. And so we were figuring, like, you know, all logistics, like, now it's like, okay, you know, unguided, like, you have these air taxi services that basically their job is just to fly you in and fly you out. They're not required to give you any more information. They're not even really allowed to give you much more information as far as the hunting, everything. They have spots that open up, they drop you off there, and you're on your own. And so we're like trying to make weight for that. That was a stressful thing of like, how are we going to make weight and trying to do this and blah, blah, blah. And we ended up having to get two planes to fly in with our gear. And we were still pretty light compared to the other people we've talked to as far as gear that we went in. But it was pretty wild. So we got up to Fairbanks on September 5th,
Fifth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we got here in the middle of the night on the 6th. So it was like that.
Yeah.
Slept a few hours in the hotel, and then we were going to make the drive in the U-Haul truck that you rented there, the single cab long bed.
Yeah, we had to ride 3 deep all the way here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's better than the box truck that we had to drive 4 deep across the bench seat last month here on the Caribou trip.
Yeah, so we got to do that and come in. And so... Ethan, I'm going to throw you right under the bus here. So
I knew
we didn't do it in the film, but I think the podcast is the right place for it. So Ethan, your lip is healing up nicely, but we get here and we're getting ready to fly in. They're like, we weren't supposed to fly in for 3 more days, but they told us if we came early and we were ready to go, that they could potentially get us out early. And I was like, I want to be out there as long as possible and be there. So the season was 10 days and we're going to be out there for 13 essentially, and we're getting ready to fly in, and Ethan looks and he can't find his release for his bow, and he was bow hunting, I was gun hunting, and that was a big deal.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Real big deal. Yeah. So, so I shoot a thumb button, and I always keep my thumb button release tucked on the side of my bino harness, and it just doesn't fall out of there. Like, I've never had an issue. And, you know, with logistics of travel, I threw my bino harness, everything in it, like right in one of my check bags. Well, it must have worked its way out of that bino harness into my Sitka duffel bag, like during the flight and just getting handled. And without knowing it, when we were in Fairbanks at the hotel room, we were getting ourselves situated, basically ready to step onto that bush plane, because if we got there in time, they were possibly going to fly us out, you know, that afternoon, like you said. So we're like, man, we want to pull in ready to go. So in that process, my release must have worked its way out, fell into the bottom of the Sitka duffel, and then like shuffling my stuff around the hotel room, it worked its way out of the bag and was in the hotel room in Fairbanks. So we get here and we're like, man, we're going out this afternoon. This is great. Like, grabbing our stuff, putting my bow together, and every bow hunter's like worst nightmare. Like, I can't find my release. And I'm like, it's just got to be in the bottom of that bag. And I just ripped everything apart. Juice helped me. And we couldn't find it. And I was like, man, it's got to be in that hotel room. I know I didn't leave it at home. And I know, like, you never come on a trip like this without a backup release. And I already knew that. Like, I know there's, you know, it's like, oh, there's a lesson to be learned. I'm like, no, I already knew that. I just was being dumb. And anyhow, the funny part was, earlier that day when we left, we were leaving the hotel in Fairbanks, we had met this very nice guy, a little strange, but very nice guy,
yeah,
in the parking lot, and he runs some sort of shuttle service, and we didn't really know much about it. He, you know, gave us his brochure and was like, yeah, hit me up next time you're in Alaska, and we're just like, all right, you know, and thank God we kept that brochure and put it, you know, in the U-Haul. Otherwise, I'd have been driving back. So I was just like, man, let me take a shot in the dark, call this guy. Oh, yeah, I asked him if he was coming this way. Asked him if he was coming this way by any chance. And he said, no, but I can. And so I was like, man, what's it going to take for you to drive this release all the way out here to me? And it's not a short drive. And he's like, yeah, give me a couple $100. I was like, done. So anyhow, this guy, he drives several hours out here, brings me my release, cost me a couple $100, whatever. I was like, okay, got my release. I'm going to fly in the morning because we needed that extra gear flight. You guys got flown in late in the day, might not have been able to get that second flight in that day anyhow. So it was really kind of like no harm, no foul. And it was like, all right, like the season didn't start for a couple days. I'm not missing anything. So now that I have my release, I go to shoot my bow and I shoot at 20, it's right on. I shoot at 40, it's right on. And I was like, just for confidence, let me shoot one at 60. I get like halfway drawn back and my D loop pops and I come back and punch myself right in the mouth. And really came to respect my right hand after that, you know. So I walked inside of the air taxi service, didn't know it. I'm like bleeding. So I'm like, I'm a hot mess at this point. Like, forgot my release. Now I've punched myself in the mouth. I'm bleeding. I just look like an idiot. And it's getting dark at this point. I come across the street to the hotel. I had brought my D-loop pliers and some some D-loop material. And
have you ever wanted to have Levi Morgan, Andy May, Johnny Stewart, and others available at all times? Well, you can with Cyber Scout from Spartan Forge. Cyber Scout is like the chat GPT for outdoors men and women. You can ask it any questions related to bow building, scouting, hunting, survival, and a whole lot more. I think you'll be impressed with how it responds. Cyber Scout is currently out now for a select group of early beta testers and will be available to the rest of you really soon. The entire app is a complete tool for planning your hunt with incredible aerial imagery mapping, journaling, deer prediction, and some of the most accurate and detailed weather data. Use the code EASTMEETSWEST to save 20%. And if you're still on the fence, give the 14-day free trial a chance at SpartanForge.ai. CVA has been America's number one selling muzzleloader brand for over a decade. Hunting with a muzzleloader opens up a ton of hunting opportunities across the U.S., and I've been using the Acura series. But they don't only make badass muzzleloaders. Their line of centerfire rifles are great quality and not terrible on the wallet. The Cascade short barrel is ideal for tight quarters, deer drives, and quick shots in the big woods. You can check out their line of muzzleloaders, rifles, and accessories for every season and every range at bpioutdoors.com/CVA. If you use the code EASTMEETSWEST10, you'll get 10% off of all CVA products, which includes rifles, muzzleloaders, and accessories.
And then, so I came in, tied a new D-loop on it, and then went outside to shoot and make sure everything was okay. Went outside. It's fairly dark at this point. I got the headlights on and shot my bow out to like 60 in the headlights, and it was on, and flew out the next morning, and we were moose hunting.
Yeah.
It actually worked out good because, like you said, there was a chance you might not have got out anyways, and the following day, we were completely socked in with rain.
Yeah.
You couldn't hardly even see the lake.
No.
So... I'm sure you were pretty embarrassed the whole time during it, but you really didn't miss out on anything.
Justin and I, the first night we got in, it was kind of like we got in right before dark, which is kind of, you know, you just get dropped off in the middle of nowhere, Alaska. You got to set up camp, got to find a spot. We couldn't find a tree to hang our food in. We were kind of panicking a little bit to get that done. And, you know, you just kind of like have that anxiety and that stress from like, it's excitement, but you still have this anxiety and stress of going in there and thinking you might have forgot something. And you know, Ethan wasn't there, and it was just like this weird mindset I was in, and I just felt anxious and couldn't get settled. And I was struggling even then to fall asleep once we got everything set up. And it just was just rainy and gloomy. And the whole next day it downpoured and it was socked in where, yeah, you could barely even see the lake that we were camped 10 feet off of. It was so bad. We just laid in the tent.
Yep.
All day long. Yeah. Read a book. I had a Jack O'Connor book that Kurt had let me borrow. And for this hunt, so I'm reading some of that and just laying there. I'm like, this is moose hunting, huh? But the season hadn't opened yet anyway, so it wasn't a big deal. And then the rain cleared just for a little bit. You popped in. The float plane dropped you off. And
instantly, life was better.
Life was, yeah, we'll go with that. Life was better. And then it was like, all right, tomorrow's opening day. And the other funny thing about this was that where there was a little bit of additional stress for me there was I thought the lake we were going to was a different lake than we were at. There just so happens to be two of the same lake names, only not very far apart, about, I don't know, 6-7 miles apart, maybe
just
less
far
than that,
enough
maybe less.
Where you didn't have it downloaded.
Just far. And I had the low res downloaded, but it wasn't great as far as imagery or anything there. So I was like, crap. You know, I had a GPS, I had, you know, Spartan Forge, I had everything you could imagine for mapping for a different area. And I was like, that's a lesson learned there. And then I was like, all right, well, I don't know anything. But at the same time, it was like, all right, you know, guys came out here years ago without mapping and looking at how to scout this stuff. It's like, we were just talking, like, let's find a high spot everything we learned about moose hunting in our research leading up to it, because none of us had moose hunted and don't claim to be, you know, quote unquote moose hunters. I mean, now we are.
We are now.
We're pretty seasoned now.
We have three seasons between us now of experience.
Yeah. But I was like, so everyone says, try to get to where you can see and just call and sit there. And that's what the game is. There's no use in walking around doing all that, which it's tough to walk around anyways. And so we found a glassing spot up on the hill. We saw it and we climbed up there, which was about a half mile from camp. And but it's the toughest half mile that I've probably walked in a while, just because walking on tundra is like, if Jack O'Connor wrote it in the book when he talked about riding or walking on tundra, it's like your legs are filled with lead, it feels like, because you're just walking on cushions, like walking on pillows as you're going the whole way up. And we found a really sweet spot that we called home, and I had the Sika glassing tarp, which they don't make it anymore. I wish they did, because that thing's freaking awesome and saved us. And we put that up over top of us, and all three of us fit underneath it, and that was home.
That was home.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time underneath that tarp. A lot of time in the rain, too.
Like you pointed out, we spent more time in that thing than we did in our own tents,
we
actually.
Did. Yeah, we definitely did.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of comfortable glassing in the tundra because it is soft. A lot nicer than sitting on a rocky hillside in the high country in Colorado or somewhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it was actually, it wasn't bad at all.
Yeah. But then just kind of like talking through the hunt here as we're going through. I mean, the first 6-7 days, we never saw a single moose.
Yeah.
Well, aside from Sophie made her first appearance on what, the first or second day?
I think it was like the third day, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like the third day. Yeah.
The third day was when that bull cruised by.
That wasn't until September 10th.
Yeah.
I have it in my notes. Yeah. It wasn't until September 10th. And so she was the day before that, I think, or so whatever it was.
I think we had like 3 days, maybe two, of absolutely nothing, right? Because the first day we were like, oh, you know, early in the season. Second day was like, well, this is moose hunting. Third day it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Where are these moose at?
Yeah. And from everybody that we had talked to, research we had done, it's like, yeah, don't expect to see a lot that first week, you know? So it was just kind of like, we weren't alarmed yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And we weren't really alarmed, but at the same time, it was like, man,
it'd be nice to see
some moose. But my training in hunting Pennsylvania big woods and low deer density areas helped in there with knowing of not seeing a whole lot. But the thing was that I think we struggled with throughout it was, we didn't know what was good and what wasn't.
Yeah.
And then we saw this cow that we named Sophie, because when you're on the side of the mountain, you have to find a lot of things to talk about, essentially. And so we were naming, you know, we called this point that she came across the water Sophie's Point.
Rightfully so,
because she'd come out and we thought she was going to be the girl that brought all the boys to the yard.
Yeah.
Sophie ended up being a pretty big letdown.
And she left her milkshake at home.
Yeah.
She had very strong morals, to say the least.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. She let us down a little bit. But nonetheless, just kind of going through, we'd basically what we'd do is we'd sit there from first light. The first few days we couldn't go up at first light because we were socked in, so you couldn't even see. So we'd sit at the lake, call, and just look out. And then once the clouds lifted, the fog lifted, we'd go up and we'd sit there till just a little bit before dark and come down. And then the last few minutes of light, we'd sit down there right by camp at the lake, do some calling. And one night, September 10th, that's what it was, September 10th, all of a sudden, I heard a stick crack. At the same time, Ethan and I kind of looked in the same direction, and then just heard a bull grunting, and he was freaking cruising.
Yeah, we looked at each other in disbelief, too.
Yeah.
Because like, it was, again, that was our first, you know, we're pretty deep in the hunt. We hadn't heard or seen of a bull, and like that first grunt, me and you looked at each other like, did we just hear what we thought we heard or hoped we heard? And sure enough, it was followed up by a second and a third, and yeah, he kept going.
Yeah. Yeah, he came through, and you got a little better look than Justin and I did, but I just saw a flash of paddles going through, and he was on the other side of the lake in like no time.
Just grunting the whole time.
Yep.
Yeah, so there's two things to point out. It was, I mean, it was after legal or ethical, like shooting hours, you know, both. And then also, we didn't have a chance to identify whether this was even a legal bull or not. Because, I mean, that's something we haven't mentioned yet. The legal bull in this particular unit has to have four brow tines on one side, at least four brow tines on one side, or be at least 50 inches wide.
Yeah.
You know, we could dive more into that, you know, but for the sake of this, we couldn't identify this as a clearly legal bull. And it was pretty apparent that he had come into our calls from that day, maybe the day before. I mean, he really zeroed in on where that call was coming from. And from what we gathered, like, this bull's probably going to be in the area in the morning. So we're just like, all right, cool. Like, he's in the area. You know, he knows that, you know, there's a cow there calling, and we're just like, he'll be there in the morning, and we'll get up and listen, call, and try to make a play on him and get a better look.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And might as well talk about the legal requirements there, because that was one of the things that worried me the most coming here, was like, I just really hope these bulls have four brow points, because it's, how is a guy from Pennsylvania supposed to know what a bull looks like over 50 inches? So there were some steps that I took to try to learn this. I spent a lot of time watching videos and hearing people talk about it. And it's like, even seasoned moose hunters struggle with it sometimes, but they're like, oh, between the eyes are, you know, average 8 inches. So you can go off from there. You know, if their paddles are lay out flatter, that, you know, gives them a little bit more width because their points, you know, stick out, and all these little things. And then also I learned from my buddy Gary over at Guardian Precision during the long range course about using MOA, my rifle scope, to be able to calculate how wide something is at a particular distance. So those were the things we were going with. And it was like, all right, man, like this is going to be tough I just really hope he has four brow points. And you and I were driving to the airport and we're like, so, you know, have you been looking at a lot of bulls pictures? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, me too. I was like, do you know notice anything in common about the brow points? We're like, yeah, there's a lot of big bulls that don't have four brow points.
Yeah, meanwhile, like, the whole time, people are trying to tell us that there's usually a correlation between, like, oh, if he's over 50, usually he's got four brow points. And then, like, we start looking more and we're just like, I feel like we're being lied to. There's a lot of really big bulls that we're seeing with, like, two brows. Yeah, so that was our worst fear, seeing like 60-inch moose and letting him walk because he's only got two brows. And everybody says, just like, man, you want to shoot him off a brow point. You don't want to guess their width because it's, you know, they kind of all look big. So we were just hoping for four brows.
Yeah, I was talking to my buddy Adam Grenda, who's been on the podcast before, and his daughter shot a cranker of a moose here a little while ago, and it was 73 inches wide, and it had two brow points on one side and maybe three on the other.
Yeah.
And that's just a giant bull. And so for anyone that's listening that's not familiar with moose hunting, they go off of measurements of width. That's how people describe a big bull, essentially. I know there's scores for it, but like, mostly you hear people talk and it's like, oh, that's a 60 incher.
That's like how people describe whitetail in Pennsylvania.
So it's like, it goes off of width. So and that'll kind of lead into, you know, I think we had seen another cow after that, way off, you know, a couple of days, and then it was, you know, pretty slow. And if I'm recalling correctly, it was not until September 14th.
Well, the night after we got the glimpse of the one,
yeah.
Then that following night back at the lake is when we heard the grunts across the lake. Could be the same bull. Then we heard him walking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then, yeah, then we had a gap of a few days.
Yeah. Well, the night that we saw that bull and heard him, we heard him that next morning.
Oh, or next morning.
Yeah, okay. But we ended up hearing then in the evening, then the following yep. day or whatever. But we heard him, so we're like, okay, what do we do? And the way Ethan and I were working, so Ethan had a bow, I had a rifle, and we just swapped every day who was kind of like the lead person or who was going to make the decisions, who was going to be the final say and get the shot, essentially. And so we decided, instead of going up to our glassing knob to set up, because he came through once in that area. So Ethan set up there with the bow. I was behind doing some raking, and Justin was there at the first thing in the morning. And then we split up to try to cover. We're like, okay, we know one moose has crossed at Sophie's Point before. It's probably good crossing. So me and Justin went over there. We're watching that. We kind of had both sides covered if that bull were to come back to the direction that he had came from the night before. And it was just a long day of looking at ducks and
swans.
Yeah.
And that was kind of about it.
Yeah, I was so convinced that bull was coming back through that opening.
I was too.
Yeah. Yeah, I was too. And then after that, it was, a few days of nothing. And September 14th was, we were sitting there. I don't remember if we were eating breakfast or just got done or something. And Ethan, you looked up and you're like, bull at Sophie's Crossing. I'm like, what? We look up and I'm like, big bull. Yeah. I grabbed this spotter. I had
just
my mate.
Just a madhouse.
It was panic, And at this point, this crossing is 1,440 yards away from us. So it's a ways off. We're like, big bull. And you start calling and you couldn't. And he wasn't hearing it at first. And then I had my bugle tube. And then you threw some grunts into that bugle tube. And then we started raking a tree. And he heard. And he looks. And we're still looking through the spotter, trying to count brow points. I'm like, dude, I'm not getting four.
No. And we went so back and forth on that bull. Like, I spotted him just with the naked eye. And then I put the binos on him. And if you remember, the first thing I said was, I don't know about brows. I don't know what's there, but I don't think he's like definitively wide enough.
Yeah.
And then we continue to go back and forth over the encounter between he's big, he's huge. And then like, I don't know.
Yeah. And he starts working in and he heard, and we just kept calling. He worked his way across the water. I was freaking epic footage through the phone scope there on my spotter of him crossing the water. And when he crossed the water with the sun hitting him, he looked like a freaking 65 inch bull at that point.
He looks giant. That's what I'm worried about in the film. Everyone's going to see that one clip and be like, there's no way he's not legal.
Yeah.
But that clip was just beautiful. But he heard Ethan calling, heard you raking, and he just followed the tree line around, and it was very apparent that he was coming in. There was never a doubt in our minds that he was coming.
His whole attitude changed as soon as he heard that call. It was very evident that he was reacting to that.
Yeah, and he blew up four or five different trees on the way in, just on a rope.
Dude, such an awesome experience. Yeah. Like, that's what we were looking to get and get out of this. And he starts coming in, and we're like, holy cow, he's going to come right out to this opening. So I'm like, we still didn't know at that point. We're like, we're pretty sure he's not legal, but we're going to get ready. And he's borderline. So I set up my rifle on the tripod. He comes out, had to range 440 yards, pops out there, range him. I look through the rifle scope, use the MOAs, start doing some measurements. I'm like, guys, I'm not coming up with anything more than 47 inches. And I'm like, he's not. And honestly, we had talked about it before. Unless our guesstimation was like 55 inches, we weren't going to really shoot because we could be off. There's a lot. And like, they have to be looking directly at you. If they're cantered a little bit, they might look a little wider. You'll get a wrong measurement. So it was like, and he's just looking up at the hill at us, but their eyesight's not very good, but he knew where the sound was coming from.
Yeah. He had us pinpointed from across the lake.
Yeah.
And the thing is, too, it's not like he was walking across an open prairie to us. He was walking through the trees, hitting trees, little openings.
Yeah.
So it's not like you guys ever had a 5-minute window to really look at him and really look at him.
You know?
You're kind of just picking your spots until he got real close to us.
Yeah. Do we get to how many? We haven't got to how many brows he had yet. But yeah, we finally discovered that this bull has three brows on each side. And, his. On both sides, one of his brows was relatively small, and we just kept looking at him, trying to like, maybe there's a fourth brow, and we just kept looking, and like Justin said, like, they're just getting these little windows, and he's got to be looking the right way. And I wasn't convinced yet that he didn't have a fourth one hiding somewhere, but then he stopped down there at the base of the hill and just stared into our souls, and that's when we were both like, or all of us were like, I can't put a fourth brow on him. And then we got a chance to really all kind of guesstimate his width, and none of us could get him to 50.
Yeah, so at that point, we kind of just sat down, and Justin was filming him. He was at 200-some yards at this point at the bottom of the hill. He just stared up for ever and didn't even blink. Like, it just...
Yeah, didn't move for 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
And then he just bedded down there.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, crap, I guess we can't call anymore for a little bit. And then we looked, and he was gone. We thought he was gone. And we're like, oh, he must have slipped out. Ethan starts calling again. Right at that point, boom, he's all of a sudden we hear crashing. Ethan and I were going to fill up our water bottles, this little stream, and we look and that bull's right there at 60 yards.
Yeah, I mean, this is, we haven't really described the landscape a ton yet, but it was steep. Like, you know, we both figured like, yeah, moose probably find their way up here, but it didn't really seem like it was very likely he was going to come up that hill. And like you said, we're just on our way to get our water bottle and he's like right there, 60 yards. And we're just like, oh man. So that was a pretty cool experience to call that bull from 1,400 yards plus into bow range was wild.
Yeah, and it was cool. Like, you know, call them all the way in. And then he got to the point where we were like, okay, he's not legal. So then we stopped calling. And instead of just working his way off, he bedded down and just waited. He'd have been there all day.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of a cool thing that I didn't really, maybe they don't do that, all of them, but I thought that was very cool that he just hung around and waited. And the second we call again, he's up and he's on us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he was right on us. And when he came in, then at one point, when he was standing there, and I was like, Justin, he's right here. And Justin starts coming over with his camera, and he's got this big lens on it. It's white, and the tripod's big, so he's got to kind of hold it up over his shoulders. And I got worried that bull was going to see that white flash and think it was antlers and come charging in. And I was like, just hold off there for a second.
Yeah,
I don't want to get into a tussle with this thing.
No, I think it's important to point out, too, that he really wasn't that interested in the cow calls. Like what he was coming into was the grunts and the rake.
Yeah.
So he was territorial. He's like, he seemed like he was looking for a fight. And that's what kind of made me laugh too, about him like bedding down at the bottom of the hill. You know, it's like, we kind of shut up and he's just kind of like, all right, I'll wait down here for you to come down. You can't wait up there forever, you know? So it was like that bull's attitude was to fight. So at that point, when he was staring at us at 60 yards, we were like, all right, let's not provoke this bull anymore. So so you hollered for Justin to sit down.
Yeah, that was crazy to be able to see. And then, so that, anyways, he saw us and he ran off.
Well, I'm shooting a new bow this year and I am pumped. After playing around with a buddy's Hoyt RX8, the smile on my face made the decision for me. The first thing I noticed with the new Hoyts were their extremely smooth draw cycles and the ability to adjust the back wall to make it rock solid like I prefer. I outfitted my own RX8 with the inline accessories that made installation extremely easy and balanced out the bow. My favorite accessory so far is a simple one. It's the Go Sticks 2.0 adjustable legs to make your bow like a tripod, but it doesn't interfere with any part of the bow or the limbs or anything like that. In addition, the integrated kickstand within the HBX Exact cams protect your string from excess wear when you put your cam into the dirt. Ground hunting or spot and stalk just got easier. If you want to experience what I'm talking about, head to your nearest Hoyt dealer and take a test drive yourself. You can learn more at Hoyt.com. The Mobile Hunters Expo is a consumer-based hunting show unlike any other. It provides an interactive learning experience where you can try all things mobile hunting and learn from the best in the business. Come experience an unbiased, community-based environment where you can improve your hunting skills and find the right equipment for your needs. I'll be speaking at the Nor'easter Show in Mannheim, Pennsylvania at Spooky Nook Sports from August 9th to 11th, 2024. So come check it out or either of the other shows in Michigan and Georgia. You can purchase tickets online at themobilehuntersexpo.com or grab tickets at the door. I'll see you there.
And he ran quite a ways. He ran down and up and went around this patch of trees. And then we never saw him go back around the lake. And we're like, oh, whatever. And like 4 hours later, think he's gone. Start calling again. All of a sudden, we see trees start to shake in this group. And we're like, holy cow, he's still there. What do you know? He comes right back in again. Not all the way to 60 yards, but he came into that same exact spot at the bottom of the hill looking up at us at 200 yards and then beds down again. And it wasn't until we were leaving right before dark that we blew him out on our thermal switch and went down the hill because they can smell freaking. Mm. I mean, he blew out a ways away from us.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we saw him running at the end.
Yeah, we went from, our attitudes were totally different the second time he came in.
Yeah.
Like the first time he came in, we were just like, man, we were like so pumped and grateful about having that experience and that encounter. And then we discovered he wasn't legal. We didn't feel comfortable shooting him. And definitely not because we didn't want to. Like, if that bull was legal, all of us would have been very happy to take that bull home.
Yeah,
so
oh,
then, yeah. So then when he wouldn't leave us alone, it just became torturous. You're just like staring at this bull, and we're like all just can't help but like try to remeasure him, and just we're like, man, just leave already.
And not only was he well within easy rifle range for bow, where he was would have been an easy stalk with the bow. Like, yeah. Either one of you could have had him very easily multiple times. So it was just like you're sitting there looking at him, and it's just like, oh, man.
And an easy pack out.
Very easy pack out. I mean, out.
It was at the very farthest a quarter mile away from the lakeshore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, and yeah, it was just, everything about it was right. And he just, you know, I mean, it was just one brow tying away from being everything that you want.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a heartbreaker. That was a tough one. But it was... It was a really cool experience to have that happen and be able to actually call in a bull, see him work in from that far away, thrashing trees, watching their mannerisms, getting to look through the spotter up close and personal and seeing like just the emotions on the bull, just kind of seeing them stand there. It's just so, so cool.
Well, like you said too, like that's what we came here for, you know, obviously. You know, you want to shoot one too, but like, you know, you hear turkey hunters talk about like getting the show. Well, we got the show,
yeah.
You know, and yep. That was however many days deep into the hunt. What were we, a week into the hunt about?
Yeah, a little over a week. A
little like 8 or 9 days.
Yeah.
And it was deep enough into the hunt where like, you know, all of us here were, you know, we still had the mindset of like, you know, tomorrow could be the day, you know, just keep grinding. No, nobody's complaining. Nobody's like super negative. Like we were jokingly, you know, we were making jokes about how, you know, how funny it was, but, you know, we were all keeping, or how slow it was rather, but we were keeping a positive attitude and just grinding. But at that point in the trip, the day before in my mind, like that's when it started to sink in. Before we had that encounter with him, we hadn't had any encounter with any bull, and it was starting to sink in like, man, we might not get the show here. Like we, you know, and we might not get that bull encounter. And I felt myself getting a little bit bummed out, like coming to terms with that, you know. Yeah. And aside from, you know, like the reality sinking in, like I might, you know, we might not come home with a bull, then it was like, man, we might not even get that encounter. And I felt myself getting bummed. And then that bull came in and just tore everything up. We called him in. We had, you know, just this amazing reaction. And after he left, you know, we turned to each other and we're like, you know what, like, regardless of what happens, you know, whether we punch our tag or not, go home happy that we got that encounter. It was like, that's what we came to Alaska for. And it was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, most definitely. And then like it was, we thought everything was like, you know, picking up and the rut's going to be full swing. And then it went to another lull. Like it was kind of slow for a couple days. And then the day before the last day of the season was probably our best day from sighting. So that Saturday was probably our best day of sightings. We saw what looked like a giant moose way off, 1.6, 1.7 miles out. And just for everyone that's also listening, like seeing that's like, oh, you see him one, you know, 1.7 miles away. Why wouldn't, you know, you go after him? Why wouldn't you, you know, do that? And so to explain, like everything I've learned from people that moose hunting was like, you don't shoot a bull at the maximum 2 miles from camp. And that's a 2 day pack out at least to for be sure. able to get something that far. But where this bull was, there was like a chain of lakes that went through, and he was on that. It would have took us 2 hours to get over to him, and he was there and gone in a matter of 2 minutes. He was chasing a cow in the opposite direction, and it was just like, it was so cool to be able to see that. Like that one looked, I mean, now it was that far away, but he looked wide enough.
Yeah, if I had to bet, that was a legal bull. You know, and like you said, like to even to try to take the, you know, there was an old boat that was stashed at this lake and, you know, had oars. Like we, to even try to go after that bull, our lake didn't even connect to that lake.
No.
You know, and if you were, so he was 1.6 miles away. If you were to walk over there, you know, through all the crooked, you know, shoreline and everything else, I mean, that was over 2 miles, at least 2 miles to go after that bull. But he didn't even stick around long enough for us to even debate whether we were going to go after him or not. It wasn't an option.
Yeah. 2 miles of tundra hiking too. That's a little different than running after a mule deer or something. It would have taken a long time to get there.
Yeah. The flat ground out there is not flat. Like no, everything no. is like these lumps covered in moss. And like, you're just so you're very uncertain of every step of, you know, the footing and everything.
Yeah.
No. Those ankles held in good though. Didn't have a single roll.
I did have one roll, but it wasn't a bad one. Yeah, I caught it pretty quick. But I think it's the going to the ankle thing, not to completely derail this conversation, but I roll my ankle in the easiest conditions normally because I'm not paying attention as much, and they're prone to rolling. But like when I'm walking in stuff like the tundra, I'm watching every step as I'm going, so it's a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard not to watch, just look straight down and watch where every single step goes.
Yeah,
if you even take your eyes off once.
Yeah, and we're trying to also watch out for grizzly bears and like...
And see a moose maybe.
Yeah, maybe see a moose. And like you're going through and it's like it's tough to not look down. Otherwise, you're tripping and it's, you know, there's some thick country that looks open from afar, and then you get down into it, it's thick. But the way our... And Ethan brought it up earlier, but we didn't really describe kind of the landscape that we were at, but... This, you know, this hunt was considered a lake hunt, so we dropped off at a lake, and it's really flat in the bottom, but we had a mountain that came right up to the lake, so that's what we were able to climb up on to be able to see down into that bottom, which was really nice to be able to have.
Yeah, and what we later learned after we got out was, like, that, the you know, that landscape that we had at that particular lake is not really common out here. Like, a lot of this lake country is just flat, right? Mm-hmm. And you're just, like... Like they told us last night, you're just looking at lakeshore and you don't have like an elevated vantage point where you could really get an eye on things. So we didn't realize how well the landscape lent itself to what we were trying to do out there at the time, because this lake was butted right up against some pretty big mountains. And we walked half a mile and were able to gain a couple hundred feet of elevation. And we were able to see for miles, like we could see more than what we could effectively hunt. So it's like... And I'm glad that we did, because, you know, how slow the moose activity was for us. If we couldn't see all that, it would have been really hard to have that self-control to not run around and drag scent everywhere, just kind of looking for moose.
Yeah. Yeah. No, overall though, like, and then the last day of the hunt essentially was just rain the whole day. We never saw a single moose. It was kind of like... just like a sad kind of, yeah. You know, day.
It was kind of heavier rain too. It wasn't like just misting or a little foggy. It was rain the whole day.
Yeah. So that was that. And at that point, you know, it was kind of settling in with us. Like, yeah, we're not going to come home with a moose on this hunt, which is tough. Like, you know, Ethan, you know, mentioned it, and it was the same for me. Like, moose has been the number one animal I've wanted to hunt my whole life. And it's not easy to make one of these hunts happen. So you obviously want to be successful with it. And that was a really hard thing, but at the same time, and like, do I think that, you know, we failed because we didn't kill something? Yes, 100%. But we learned a lot, and I don't really think nobody deserves anything, especially on a first time, to be able to do it. I was hoping that we'd get lucky and it would happen, but it was moose hunting is interesting. And what we learned from, we met a bunch of other hunters that have been coming and doing this for years and years. We met some awesome guys from South Dakota and Alaska and hung out with them and drank some beers and stuff last night. And like, they're, you know, it's like a cult, the people that get into it and do it, but it's a lot of sitting, waiting, and a lot of silence. Like, it's a lot of nothing. It's not your elk hunting. It's a patience game. It's a pretty crazy type of experience. It's difficult to be able to explain, but this trip for me, you know, essentially we were in there for 13 days, absolutely no cell service, no, you know, we had our inreaches, so we had some, connectivity to the outside world a little bit, but like, it was the longest that I've been without, you know, having, you know, cell service or going back to the truck. Or, you know, we did the 21 day hunt in Montana last year, but every 5-6 days we go back to the truck, get more food, you know, do whatever. And it was just like completely remote for that time period. That's a win in itself, just being able to do that and work forward to it.
Yeah. It was a couple of things. It was funny, like leading up to this hunt, I was very aware that it wasn't going to be as active. Like when we're actually the hunting aspect of it wasn't going to be as active as like an elk hunt or something like that. But provided we got a bull or maybe even two down throughout this trip, like that is a lot of meat that you have to move on your back to the lakeshore through uneven ground, you know, and unknown distance. So I trained really hard for this hunt just because I didn't want to get. So again, like you and I had never hunted together. We kind of jumped off the deep end of the pool and I was like, man, I want to be prepared, but two, like, we're not going to get a bull on the ground and then like have Bo be like, man, I wish this guy prepared a little bit more, you know? So I trained pretty hard for this hunt and we joked about it a lot throughout the week. It's like, you know, them come into this hunt and we're just like, we hike a mile a day and then just sit down and just eat like calorie dense meals for, for 12 hours.
Yeah.
we jokingly said this is probably the first backcountry hunt we came out of weighing more than when we went.
a lot of snacking going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially you guys. You guys are heavy on the snacks. I was a bit of a minimalist, I guess, in that
regard. Dude, I don't know how you eat such little food. Like, I'd be dead on the mountain.
Okay.
Yeah.
I added up the calories, and I'm like right at like 2,000. Like, so I was right on throughout the day. So it's not how little food I bring in. It's how much food you guys bring in.
Shit, I had 2,000 calories a day. I just trail mix.
Yeah, and I'm not talking crap on Juice's snacks because he was nice enough to keep feeding me some of those olive oil and cracked black
those
pepper Triscuits. Yeah,
those are good.
Yeah, I might have a new snack when I get home.
Yeah, dope. Yeah, I'd say I probably had a little bit too much food. I had about 4,000 calories a day, and I could have went with a few things less. But it honestly, though, I looked forward to eating each of those things at the milestones of the hours that would go by as you're sitting there for 12 hours a day, just looking out. But I will say the one nice thing about this compared to hunting whitetails during the rut in Pennsylvania, at least I can see further than 20 yards, and it's a beautiful view.
Yeah,
to be able to see.
Speaking of the beautiful view, we got the full show of the fall colors too, and we showed up, everything was just green.
Yeah.
And when we left, I'm sure Bo will have some pictures on his Instagram, but it was just all the trees were turning yellow, and there was entire mountainsides that were just yellow.
Yeah.
It's hard to describe until you see it, but it was beautiful.
Yeah, it's so coming from like the eastern hardwoods, you know, we're not strangers to like fall colors, but this is so different. All these birch trees were just like just bright yellow. It just looked like highlighter yellow across these mountains. And you know, we had mentioned the mountains there, but like this was the most beautiful place I've ever hunted. I mean, these were some big rugged mountains. I mean, our lake was sitting at 2,000 feet of elevation, and the mountains there on the other side across the lake from us were, that peak was at 7,500, and they just shot straight up from the valley floor. And it was, man, it was gorgeous. And the last day we came out, you know, we had mentioned the rain the day before. So when that was the last day of season. So then, you know, the day after that, we were waiting to get flown out, and some of the clouds started to lift a little bit. And, you know, what was rain the day before was snow up on top of the mountain. So you have like these snow capped peaks with like highlighter yellow birch leaves all over, you know, below the tree line. It was gorgeous.
Yeah. No, it was so cool to be able to see that and see the season change. And it, you know, got colder as we were there, you know, the nights got colder. And let's kind of shift a little bit and talk about some gear stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, let's talk about what worked, what didn't work, and just kind of go through it. Let's start with this. What were some key things that you felt like were 100% necessary for a moose hunt?
What wasn't necessary is I could have left my release in Fairbanks. Turns out I didn't need that.
Yeah.
Man, I felt really good about my gear list. I know that I erred on the lighter side of things for sure, but I never once felt like, oh man, like I shorted myself. I don't have something that I need, you know, but there's a couple of things definitely throughout the week where I was like, yeah, I'm going to add that, you know, looking at you guys and observing your stuff, definitely a couple things. And that's the nice thing about hunting with other people. You could kind of adopt their systems and their kits and stuff that you're like, I never thought about that. So, one that I was like, man, it should have been obvious to me that I really liked about you guys is really in your food system. I just kind of had a dry bag. I hucked all my food into. I laid it out on the counter at home and like laid all my meals out day by day and then like swept it into a bag like an idiot. Yeah. And had Ziploc bags for trash and stuff to bring along, obviously. But you guys had individual days laid out in separate Ziploc bags, and that was like a much cleaner, tidier system. So I'm going to adopt that for sure. And the other for me was the glassing pad. I was fine. Yeah, I'm not. And again, we talked about that tundra ground just being like so soft and spongy. It was pretty comfortable to sit in. But the thermal barrier of, you know, just having that under you. And I was, you know, I would take my Gore-Tex out or something and my raincoat and sit on the ground so I didn't get a wet butt. And obviously those Timberline pants had the Gore-Tex in them too. So I never got wet, never had an issue. It's not like I was like, oh man, I kind of screwed myself. But I'm like, yeah, for how much that thing doesn't weigh, I'm going to definitely add some glassing pad into my kit.
What about you, Juice? What were some things that you thought were like super important or like gear items that you're like, man, I can't live without this, or things that you would change up?
Well, I bought the Timberline suit for this trip. First time ever using it. I should have just bought it years ago. I've always wanted to, but I never really needed it.
Yeah.
And man, that thing held up so good.
Yeah.
You know, I wore that. I mean, we all wore our Timberline set pretty much every single day.
Yeah. I mean, and so that's the sick of Timberline pants for anyone that's listening.
But those, and then you know, it's kind of the same as like an Alcana. Good pair of boots and gaiters is 100% necessary. We all had top of the line boots. Anything less for a hunt like this, you'd be absolutely miserable.
Yeah,
my boots were like, my feet weren't wet, but my boot, like the outside of my boot itself, was wet the entire trip.
Yeah,
from the first minute we got there.
Yeah, no, most definitely. And what about anything else you can think of that you thought was super important?
I'm trying to think. I mean, the tarp was a good one. A lot of my stuff's just camera gear, you know, having a good rain set's obviously very important too. We all wore rain pants a lot, raincoats a lot.
Yeah.
You guys had good optics with, so that helped too.
Yeah, no, definitely. I guess for me, it would be like, yeah, the layering system was like, I felt very dialed with the way my system was. The Timberline pants, they're my favorite pants Sika makes. And like, For anything below 60 degree weather, it's like the seat is waterproof on it. So you sit down, you don't get wet. The knees are waterproof on it. So like when you have your gaiters on that go up to your knees, and then you have the water, you're basically above the knee, somewhat waterproof when you're going through brush and doing all that. But the boots things, I'd bought a pair of Schnee's Beartooth 200 gram insulated boots. Phenomenal. Really enjoyed those boots. And you had a set of Crispies on, and you had, and Ethan, you had a set of Schnee's as well, and we all were happy with our boot choices.
I
was glad that I went with 200 gram insulation. That was nice on those cold days.
Yeah, mine were uninsulated. You had what, the Beartooth?
Yeah
So I have the Timberline boots. They're uninsulated, and it was never an issue, but like, just comfort, it was like, yeah, could use a couple hundred grams for sure, you know. But it was, I was all right without it. But definitely next time, I think I'd go with the 200 gram insulation.
Yeah, and then I also the Sika Jetstream jacket. I wore that a lot on this hunt. You know, windproof and highly water resistant. Having that, and then the full merino set. This was like, you know, I never really changed any of that stuff out besides underwear and socks, but like the same base layer and mid layer. So I had the 120 long sleeve and then the 330 hoodie, and that was a great system. And even those 330 weight gloves that I had that were merino, they were new ones that Sika came out with, and this was the first hunt I wore them on. Wore them every day, and they held up great. Every time they get wet, I just stick them inside my puffy jacket while I was sitting there glassing, and my body heat would dry them. It was like a really, really solid system. But and then just to add to what you guys said, I mean, rain gear, man, you can't come to Alaska without good rain gear. That's just kind of the nature of beast, something that's breathable and that you can hike in a little bit and have that. So that was nice. I had the Stormfront jacket and Cloudburst pants, which neither of them are currently in production, but those, I've had those for a while, and they worked out great for me to be able to see. Having a spotting scope was good. I don't think we both needed one, which we didn't then, but that was nice for being able to check. So I had my Maven, the CS1 spotter, and then just a set of binos, and we just basically glassed. You know, I didn't really use my tripod much for glassing. You did. I just, you know, kind of just went off my knees and just looked, because a lot of it you can see without even using binos. Moose are pretty big animals, so I just scan with my eyes and then kind of look in detail with the binos.
Yeah, I had to start having some, you know, some pretty impressive way out there, naked eye moose spots, because I was catching some heat about every moose I spotted was in the water, and I only spot moose in the water, which proved to be false. But yeah, there's some accusations made. But no, the spotting scope, for everybody listening too, like, that came into play when we laid eyes on a bull. Like, we didn't use it to find bulls. It was like, okay, let's identify if that bull's legal. That's where that came in really useful. You know, it had we spotted a bull way off that, you know, we weren't sure about width, and, you know, you're like, does he have four brow tines or not? That could save you a couple miles of hiking to find out.
Yeah.
So, you know, but to the clothing, our systems were very similar. I was wearing the Merino, the new Merino from Sitka as well, the base layers. So I had the 220 boxers, and then I had 120 top on, you know. And the thing too is, like, we talked about this a little bit. A lot of times you get away without that base layer on the bottom because the Sitka boxers are fairly long. They come down, you know, to like the top of your knee, and then your socks come up to almost the bottom of your knee. So you kind of almost have like a full length base layer on anyways. But then I had my Ambient on, and I can't say enough about how awesome that Ambient hoodie is. That thing is one of my favorite pieces of gear that Sitka's come out with. And we had talked about it too. Like, if you want a gateway drug into Sitka, like, get that Ambient hoodie. If you're curious what Sitka's all about, like, that thing, it's really impressive, like, how well it does to insulate you, but, like, not sweating you out and being able to dump the heat when you're being active. And then the Timberline pants, yeah, we all wore those. And then that Jetstream jacket, just the workhorse of the big game lineup for Sitka, for sure. Yeah, and then the Puffy, you can't cheat yourself. Like, I mean, in Alaska, you have to have the Puffy, you have to have the good, you know, good rain gear. And it's just kind of mind boggling in Alaska how quick the weather changes. I mean, it's outlandish, like, what you could see in a day.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, now, like, this is, you know, this is like one of those hunts where it's like, I believe, you know, having good gear all around is pretty dang important. But when you're getting dropped off and left there, now, you know, I was reading the Jack O'Connor books from the 1940s, and they're just walking around in wool pants and, you know, smoking cigarettes and doing all that kind of stuff. So yes, you can do it, and people have done it. I've looked at old photos of when my grandpa was up here and my girlfriend's grandpa that used to hunt Alaska a lot, and they were, you know, in their flannels and stuff. Like, it can be done, but man, to be out there for that long, being comfortable. Yeah, and not having to bring a ton of bulk. That's the other thing, is like, you can get away with some other stuff probably, but if you have to have a lot of change of clothes from getting wet, right. Like, I never changed my pants the whole time for 2 weeks. Like, it was like, they get wet, I get my sleeping bag at night, they dry out by the morning, I throw all my wet stuff in my sleeping bag, cook it dry by the morning. It was like, I felt pretty dialed with it, and the tent setup was great. I love that Hilleberg. I have the, oh man, I'm probably gonna mess it, the Katum GT3 tent. My buddy Michael Palladino, him and I split on that. We bought it for last time we went to Alaska, and honestly I haven't used it since, because it's a pretty bomb proof shelter, but, and it's a little bit heavier than like the Seek ones or any of the other ones that I've used, but it's pretty comfortable. It's got nice big vestibules on each side. You know, Justin and I both slept in that. We were good. And then Ethan had a Stone Glacier tent that he used.
Yeah, so this is my first season running that tent. We used it on the caribou hunt last month. And then that was pretty mild weather. And then definitely got to test it on this hunt with colder temps and a lot of rain. And man, that tent just really, it did really well. Yeah, I'm really happy with that tent.
No, that's good. I'm trying to think what else is a piece of gear. I mean, bringing books on something like this is important. I went through two books. I read Jack O'Connor's book, and then I also read Steve Rinella's book, just self-titled Meat Eater. And that was a really good read to be able to have. And it was funny. The one night I was reading Jack O'Connor's book, and I was just sitting there by the lake as it was getting dark, he's talking about I think he was sheep hunting, and he was talking about as it gets into September and the birch trees start to turn yellow and they look like candles across the sky as it gets dark, and it was getting dark. I look up, and that's exactly what I was seeing as I was reading the pages looking up, and it was like, that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I was reading, Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac during the hunt too. And just that book, just, you know, talking about wild things and wild places. It's, you know, and then you just look up at what we were looking at for 13 days and it's just like, man,
yeah,
hit home.
No, Alaska's a freaking wild place, that's for sure. And I love coming here. It's definitely not cheap. It's definitely not easy to get here and to be able to do it. It takes a lot of time commitment, a lot of traveling, a lot of everything. Like, not gonna sugarcoat it and say that's easy at all, but man, I really like getting to do it. It was a tough pill to swallow to miss elk hunting, just to, because I love elk hunting and the action of it, but this was obviously a pretty dang good substitute.
Yeah, you know, and you touched on it earlier, and not to sugarcoat stuff. It was, you know, it was a tough pill to swallow to not punch a moose tag on this one, you know. I mean, it sounds cliche to talk about too, but like, we were both, you know, we were both completely happy with whoever shot a moose. You know, I think realistically we were like, man, like I we hope to shoot, you know, I don't want to say expected, but we're like, man, we should get a moose because you're hunting with the rifle. I got the bow. We're pretty covered. But we both hope for two moose, but realistically, it'd probably be like a moose. And then all of a sudden, we're like, we're not coming home with a moose at all. And like you said, you know, there's no illusions, right? Like, we've been moose hunters for 10 days. Like, none of us feel like we're owed anything or like we've earned a moose or anything. You know, it's one of the things that makes these experiences special is like, there's no correlation between how much you want it and what you get in return, you know, or how much money you paid. And we put a lot of financial strain on ourselves and coming in this trip. And it was like the top of our bucket list for both of us. And you look forward to this ever since you're a kid and you're just like, you want it so bad, you know, but you're not, doesn't mean you're owed anything, you know? And it was like, man, we're not coming home with a moose. And that one hurt a little bit more than any other hunt that I, you know, that I didn't tag out on. And, you know, call it what it is, right? Like, it's an unsuccessful hunt. Like, you know, it was a great trip, but an unsuccessful hunt. You know, I'm not going to sit here and be like, well, define success, you know? So.
Right. And, you know, the one thing, the positive that we can take away from this is like, we had a bull that probably would have measured right at 50.
Yeah.
And collectively we decided to pass it on our first moose hunt.
Yeah.
And I think for us having like realistic expectations and going into the hunt and looking at that bull right there, it was right there for us.
Yeah.
And we all said, we're not doing it. It's too close. So I think we all kind of, you know, we made the responsible decision there. You know, maybe some guys would have been like, it's close. It's 50, 51. Let's go. Let's just see if we can get it. But we were very calm and collective. It was at 60 yards and we were like, nope.
Yeah. No, and yeah, that's a good point. And to me too, it's like, we talked about it earlier about hunting partners and choosing it, but like, if you're going to do a hunt like this, just make sure you find somebody to go with or people to go with that are on the same page as you. Make sure you communicate. We talked about this a lot out there, like clear communication, expectations. It's like, you know, like Ethan and I both went into it being perfectly okay if the other one shot a bull and we didn't. And that was like the full on honest, and you'll see that throughout the hunt if it's not that way, you know, where someone's like, yeah, starting getting a little angry, a little testy about, you know, certain things are not going their ways. But it's like, that's, we had clear expectations on that, and that's what it was set. And it was like, all right, whoever's up to shoot that day, you know, we all make decisions collectively, but at the end of the day, that person makes that final decision to go do it. And like, we had those clear expectations going into it, and I thought that worked out well, because I mean, you're spending a freaking ton of time. I don't care if you're with, you know, the your favorite person on earth, that's a lot of time to spend with anybody, you know. So yeah, it's important to find the right people and have those clear expectations.
Yeah, you don't want to start hashing that stuff out when you're looking at a bull. Be like, oh, like, how do we handle this? Like, we went into this hunt and we laid out, I think, every scenario that we could imagine. Like, all right, like, what, like, let's get on the same page before we ever, you know, leave home. Be like, how's this going to go? How are we going to handle this? How are we going to handle that? And like, I think before we even spoke the words, we were already like on the same page. You know, we alternated like whose, you know, quote unquote turn it was. But also too, like, using the bow, like, if there was, had we seen a legal bull that we were going to go after and there was zero chance that I'm getting into bow range, like you're up to bat,
yeah.
You know? And I'm sure that if we had a bull that was like right in a sweet spot for a bow, you know, you're like, you would have been like, why don't you give that a shot?
Yeah,
if it doesn't definitely. Work out, I got the rifle. So, you know, and that you can't say enough about picking the right hunting partners.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, there's teamwork that goes into everything, but especially a hunt like this, from everything, from getting to the spot to the food system to calling, raking trees, helping each other decide if the bull is legal or not, then all the way down to packing out. So as opposed to like a deer hunt where if you're with someone who's, you get along with and it's just okay, you're hunting different tree stands. But when you're sitting in the rain for 13 hours together on day five and it's consecutive like that, you need to be dialed in. There's just no doubt about it.
Yeah, it was just nice, like, this group, it was, you know, nobody's like, hey, why don't you go do this? Why, like, everybody's pulling their weight constantly, and just, you know, it's like, you kind of got to get in line to you know, because people are already just getting stuff done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was very happy with how all that went, I guess I got my preparation for getting my butt kicked in the tree now not seeing deer for, I just got that ready, you know. Yeah. Got my old day sits in early in the season.
Yeah, knocked the rust off a little
oh man, no, but overall great hunt, great experience. Is there anything else you guys think about like that we missed on touching? I mean, I know there's a lot of things and there will be a film that comes out on it and everything, but
no, I think we covered it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, well, cool. All right. Well, let's wrap this one up. We actually got to get out of this this cabin here shortly and make our trip back to the airport, or a long way to get back home to Pennsylvania and Minnesota. So I appreciate you guys, and just let everybody know where they can find you. Justin, start with you.
Basically just Instagram, Justin Mueller Photography. You'll see photos of this trip, bull post. I'm sure he'll tag me in it. You can just go straight off of there.
We'll see if I tag you.
We'll see. Well, we'll see if I give you the photos.
Well played.
Yeah. We can keep going to see if I pay you.
All right. I'll interject here. Yeah. yeah. So just same thing. Instagram, last name spelled last name DMI is spelled DEMI. And then, so the handle's DEMI Ethan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So check them out, and want to book a bow fishing trip or do any waterfowl hunts or anything, get a hold of Ethan.
Let's do it. We still got to get you on a waterfowl hunt. I know you got a handful of people close in your network that are chipping away at you, but yeah. I feel like that is one other thing. I'm sorry. We're getting a little bit closer with you. We got you identifying some waterfowl on this hunt.
Yeah.
we'll do it.
All these ducks and all the stuff, and you guys are just like, oh, look, that's a pin-tailed redneck, whatever, you know, going through all these
point things. Proven. We have some work to do. Yeah, we're getting there.
Yeah. I was like, I don't know what the heck. That's a duck. That's a duck.
I've been working on bow for a while now, so I'm glad Ethan's on my team. Yeah. The waterfowl stuff. We'll get him there.
I have a handful of friends that have been trying to get me to go waterfowl hunting, and I just keep putting off. It's not that I don't want to do it. It's just the time commitment, and I just don't want to get into something else. Like, that's my big thing.
Yeah, I hear you.
But maybe I'll make it happen at some point and just do it as like a one-off thing. But all right, we'll close this one out. But thank you guys. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks, Bo.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.